Welcome to Chapter 2 on Mutual Funds, Investments for the Masses. And although our previous chapter was very important because it laid the great groundwork for what we're going to do for the entire semester, this chapter is arguably more important. Why? Because chances are you're going to be investing in a mutual fund through your 401k, 403b, other employer-sponsored retirement plan at work, or maybe a Roth IRA or a savings account for education or the like. Why? Because mutual funds are the investments for the masses. After we're done our journey together, you're going to have a pretty good idea of whether you want to put in the time and the effort it takes to make prudent long-term decisions with regard to stocks especially, and even bonds. Or you don't want anything to do with it. You don't have time, you're living your life, you got the kids to take care of, your job. So for you, there are mutual funds. And we'll see, they're not perfect. No investment is. They really do make a lot of sense for the vast majority of us working grunts. Why? Because mutual funds will bore you to wealth. Right. People love to talk about the stocks they bought and did really well. They don't usually talk about the ones that blew apart and dissolved into a pool of tears. But mutual funds are not really exciting. What we're going to find out, though, is it's not without its consternation. Choosing a mutual fund or funds is the hardest part. But once you've done that, there's not a whole lot you got to do, as we're going to see. So let's get started on slide number 2. What is a mutual fund? So review from chapter 1. A mutual fund is an investment company. There are other types of investment companies, but mutual funds are the most popular and prominent investment company that invests its shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities. Now, you're not going to hear the term investment company that often, unless you work in the industry. That's the legal term. Mutual fund is the popular term. And the two wonderful advantages you get are professional money management and diversification. Now, some people might poo-poo these two items. And, you know, for some people, they may be not appropriate. They want to make their own decisions. And they don't want to diversify, they want to concentrate. But for the vast majority of us, it makes sense. These people are paid to do their job. Some do a very good job, some do not so good a job. Each fund has a specific objective, and there are over 12,000 funds? Are you serious? Are there 12,000 breakfast cereals in the aisle? It seems like it. No, there are 12,000 different cars out there. What's going on here? Well, we're going to see for various reasons. The mutual fund industry has exploded. And now you have 12,000 choices to choose from. So that's the hardest part. As we said, many people are going to wind up investing in mutual funds for their retirement account investments. Some 403Bs and the like, 401Ks, allow you to buy individual securities, individual stocks or bonds, but usually they charge you a great deal for doing that, and it's not typical. It's usually the exception, not the rule. So here is our unprofessional. I don't know if you remember the graphic from chapter 1. This is my graphic. Thank you, Farron, but here we are. I'm really good at stick figures, folks. Have you noticed? Here we are. We're the little people, and there more and more of them are women. Those are women. And we give our $50, $100 a month, or more if we can afford it, to the people in the top hats. And thankfully, more and more of them are women, because it turns out, it's already been proven, that women make better investors than men. I'll let you decide why that is. I'm not going to touch that one with a 10-foot pole. But what they do is they take the millions, billions of dollars that are given to them by millions of people, and they create a pool of money. And I know it kind of looks like a potato, my apologies, but it's supposed to be a little pool. a mutual fund. That's where the name comes from, right? And with these pools of money, these mutual fund managers with the top hats don't invest in 5 or 10 stocks or bonds. They invest in 100 or 200 or 500 different individual stocks or bonds. And if they invest in stocks, it's called a stock mutual fund. If they invest in bonds, it's called a bond mutual fund. And if they invest in the cash short-term instruments that we looked at in Chapter 1, it's called a money market mutual fund. But you know what? You're not going to hear that. You're not going to hear money market mutual fund. You're just going to hear money market, because that's what people call them. Now, in our graphic, we see just the beginning of the explosion of different types of mutual funds with what's called a balanced fund that invests in stocks and bonds. And it turns out that this, for many people, especially as you get older, is a wonderful combination. I know nothing's perfect, but for a lot of us who are very risk averse but still want to invest somewhat in stocks but need that ballast, stability that bonds can give us, a balanced fund is an excellent choice, as we will see as we continue. So keep this graphic in mind. Look at what happened to the mutual fund industry. Now, the data for 2023 will come out in May. So this is a year old. This is the 2023 fact book. The 2024 fact book, published by the Investment Company Institute at ICI.org, the mother lode, will come out in May or so. So it's early in 2024. In 1940, that's a very propitious, like the word propitious, very important year in the investment company world, because that's when the Investment Company Act of 1940 was created by the folks in Washington. Yes, they can work together. It's been shown in the past they've done it. There were mutual funds before this, but they really weren't well regulated, and there were some problems going on here. Some of the regulators weren't too happy about what's going on with these mutual funds, and the mutual fund industry was charging ahead. So there were approximately 70 mutual funds out there. 30 years later, there were 350. In 1980, there were 600. But look at what happened between 1980 and 1990, from 600 to 2000. And then from 1990 to 2000, it jumped over fourfold, and we round up with 9,000 funds. And since then, in the last 20 some odd years, we've added over 3,000. Yeah, that's the hardest part of mutual funds, is choosing one or choosing maybe a couple. You don't need that many because you already have diversification from the mutual fund. In fact, sometimes you'll meet somebody who has 17 or 20 mutual funds, and you just think, come on, it's overkill, you know. They sort of cancel one another out after that. Slide number 5. In 1980, 5 million Americans owned mutual funds, holding just 3% of their household financial assets. By December of 2022, over 120 million Americans in almost 72 million households own mutual funds. That's over half of all United States households. And why is that? Right, employer-sponsored plans, 401ks, 403bs, other types of retirement accounts for employees. Now, this is as of the end of 2022. We're probably going to see a jump, because 2023 was actually a pretty good year, considering 2022 was a pretty harsh year. But $29 trillion, holding over 20% of the household's financial assets. So now, mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary. What does that mean? They hold on to some other people's money, right? They're a financial intermediary, followed by the banks, commercial banks, and then the life insurance companies. Yeah, the life insurance companies are often called the invisible bankers. So the mutual fund industry is a potent industry, a powerful industry in our economy. And they're only becoming more and more popular all around the world. In fact, some of the long-term mutual fund companies here in the United States have been aggressively marketing overseas. So the rest of the world is saying, hey, me some too. Where did they actually start? Believe it or not, they started in Scotland. And that mutual fund that was started in, I think, the 1880s or something like that, is still around. The first mutual fund in the United States was 1924, MFS, Massachusetts Financial Services, Investors Trust. So it's proved almost 100 years, right? 100 years for MFS. They've proved their worth. As with any investment, there are advantages and there are disadvantages. But they really are the investments for the masses. Slide number 6. Now, this graphic is getting a little too busy. I have to pare it down a little bit, maybe. But we see in 2017, before the noticeable drop, $13 trillion, and then down to $10 trillion, and then growth throughout the 2010s and into the 20s, and notice the big drop from 2021 to 2022. 2022 was a pretty tough year for stocks and bonds. Not the worst, but certainly not the best. And but you have to go back to 1969, I think, to see both stocks and bonds drop that precipitously. So bonds usually hold up pretty well, but not in 2022 when interest rates rose. And we'll see that when we get to bonds much later. We'll discuss that in detail later on. But pretty amazing, isn't it? These guys are holding. Now, 2023, we're probably going to see back over $30 trillion because the stock market actually did pretty well. And the bond market did pretty well, not as much as the stock market, but pretty good for the bond market. So we'll see them over $30 trillion. What are the advantages of mutual funds? Well, if somebody were to call you at 2 o'clock in the morning and wake you out of a deep slumber, I'm not going to do it, but if somebody were, the first two things you would say would be diversification and professional money management. Not necessarily in that order. But those are the main advantages of mutual funds. Diversification is a good thing, in my humble opinion. There are others who are going to disagree and believe that you should be highly concentrated. Fine, you know, we wish them a lot of luck, but it's a two-edged sword. It can work in your favor and work in your disfavor. Diversification gives you some, we don't want to use the word safety, but it just helps you avoid large losses, assuming you're well diversified. And of course, that's in the eye of the beholder. But the pool diversification allows us to buy into a diversified portfolio of securities for the collective benefit of us individual investors. This variety provides some safety that is difficult for an individual investor to obtain on their own. Now, it's not impossible. It's just more difficult because we need more money to buy, you know, at least 10, 20 different stocks. The professional money managers are supposed to know what they're doing. They're certainly getting paid well enough, and some are very, very good, and some are not so good. And we're going to hear about the controversy over whether we should allow actively managed professional money managers to make our decisions for us, or should we use passive management? Should we not allow them to make decisions and simply buy stocks off a list? We'll discuss that in detail. We are referring to what are called index funds. Another very cool thing about mutual funds is that you don't need a whole lot of money. $25, $50 a month, folks. How much do you have to invest? Well, when I talk to people, they'll sometimes say, well, I want to wait until I have $5,000 or $10,000 and I'll start investing. And I think, well, when's that going to happen? When are you going to have $5,000 lying around the house? Get started now. Or if they'll say, well, I really don't have anything to invest, I say, how much is your cell phone payment? And they go, well, you know, it's supposed to be $50, so I wind up downloading a lot of ringtones. Yeah, get started now. Now, I mean, not today. Just don't jump up and down and say, okay, I'm going to get started right now. Stick with us till the end of the semester, especially when you're younger. You have a lot of time, but you want to get started by your later 20s, early 30s, you know, when you start to settle down. So that's a very cool thing, the low initial outlay of capital. And then I wish I had coined this phrase. I didn't. I got it from the wealthy barber, David Chilton. It's called the PETA factor. Pain in the... Yeah, fact. Right. Once we've decided upon our mutual fund or funds, there's not much else we have to do. You know, we have to check them every year or so. But really, we are allowing someone else to make the decisions for us. And if we find a mutual fund company that's been around for decades, done well in good times, and more importantly, bad times, then unless the world ends, we should do well in the future. No guarantees. What are the disadvantages? Well, guess what, folks? There's a reason this industry is so popular. It's very profitable. There are drawbacks of any investment, disadvantages of any investment, and in the case of mutual funds, there are transaction costs and annual operating expenses. Well, duh. I mean, if they're doing it right, if they're actively managing the mutual fund, that means they're going all around the world and knocking on doors of the car manufacturers and the energy companies and the healthcare companies and the technology companies. It's not an easy task, as we're going to find when we start looking at stocks. It's a very time-consuming task, and it takes a lot of brain power. So, yes, we're going to pay for that. Now, if we wind up with mutual funds that don't do that active management called passive management, then those costs should be much lower. Should be. Be careful. Sometimes insurance companies especially will sneak high-cost index funds into your 401k later. Now, we're going to pay for our services. Well, it makes sense, right? But another thing that mutual funds have that can be a disadvantage is that they don't match the market's performance. Wait a minute. Aren't they supposed to know what they're doing? Well, think about it, folks. The market itself doesn't have any transaction costs, doesn't have any annual operating expenses. So you have to beat those costs that you're incurring to run the fund just to break even. Plus, some mutual fund managers will roll the dice, and there's a reason for that. They will be overly aggressive because of the competition is so fierce. And this is changing, thankfully. But in the past, many companies would take a new kid off the block, you know, right out of the best schools, and boy genius, girl genius, and say, here, kid, here's $1 billion. See what you can do with it. And so they understood the game. They knew that if within 18 months, 2 years, they weren't producing, they're out of the door. So it incentivized them to take higher risk. And if it worked out, great. If it didn't work out, oh well, they were going to get fired anyway. That's, in my humble opinion, not in the best interest of the shareholders. So I've always followed companies, and more companies are doing this, that give their mutual fund managers much more time to ease into the job and then to think for 8 years into the future. And we're going to see 3, 4, 5 years is about as long as you'd want to think about the future later. We'll discuss this later. But I know one company that it looks at their managers after 4 years and then looks at their managers after 8 years, which I think is a little long, but it makes them think long term. So those are the drawbacks. Now, get your thinking toque out, you know, get your papers of paper or whatever you're going to make your notes on, because you're going to be the investment guru, so you need to understand these differences, and you're going to hear people make some assumptions about the differences between different mutual funds, and they're wrong. They're not precise. You're going to be precise. Traditionally, there were two major types of mutual funds, open-end and closed-end. By far, open-end mutual funds are the most popular. This is a type of investment company in which investors buy shares from and sell them back to the mutual fund itself, with no limit on the number of shares that the fund can issue. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of investors. So at any time, you can buy more shares simply by sending them more money, or redeem those shares by saying, I need my money back. Give me $10,000. Well, what's going to happen is you give them $10,000 or $100 or whatever, they're going to issue new shares to you. And when you ask for your $100 or $5,000, whatever it is, they will redeem those shares, which means those shares will be destroyed. When people refer to a mutual fund, they are almost exclusively referring to an open-end mutual fund. So be careful. They're going to say mutual fund. You're going to interpret that as open-end mutual fund. Now, as of December 2022, there were almost 8,300 of these things, totaling $22 trillion in assets. So by far, they are still the largest category of mutual funds. There's another category that we'll take a look at later on that's catching up with them, and many people believe they will supplant them soon, but that's not there. We're not there yet. The next category, traditionally, were closed-end mutual funds. Notice they're only about 3.5% of all the mutual funds out there. Instead of creating and purchasing, issuing and destroying, selling, redeeming the shares as people buy shares and sell shares, the closed-end company operates with a fixed number of shares. They start off with 10 million shares, and that's it. They're not going to issue any more shares. They're not going to destroy any more shares. So what happens is these shares look like a stock. They look like a stock in that there are a set number of shares that are outstanding. Now, if you want to buy these shares, you need to do it through your brokerage firm. You were going to say, I want to buy so many shares of this closed-end mutual fund, as if you were buying shares of a stock. That's how it works. They're not as popular, and the number of mutual funds and the amount of money that they are managing is shrinking. They're becoming less and less popular. There were only 440 of these, 441 as of December 2022, only $250 billion. So remember, there were over 8,000 open-end mutual funds, 20-some trillion dollars, and 441 closed-end mutual funds, $252 billion. So I have actually never met anybody who's bought these. I've never bought them. I know one broker who used to push them, who thought they were the cat's meow. They're disappearing. But you should know what they are. You need to know what they are because you're an investment guru. The net asset value on slide number 11 is the underlying value of one share in a particular mutual fund. So every day, the mutual fund company is every day that the market is open, they're required at the end of the day to add up the value of the securities, subtract any liabilities, any costs that they have to pay for, and then divide by the number of shares. And so the open-end mutual funds are sold once per day or redeemed at the net asset value. Now, some funds have a load, a commission that we'll look at in the next presentation. But closed-end mutual funds are bought and sold on the open market. So they're not necessarily bought and sold at the net asset value. In fact, they're often sold at a discount. 25 cents or whatever it is, maybe more. Sometimes they're sold at a premium. But they are very rarely priced at their net asset value. So if you have an open-end mutual fund, you look on the internet or whatever, on their website, you'll see that's the net asset value as of this day. If you bought the shares, that's what you're going to pay that day. If you sold your shares, that's what you will receive that day. Whereas the closed-end mutual funds, you don't know. The price is going to bounce around, and you don't know exactly. But it'll be close. It won't be far from the net asset value. Here is a formula for the net asset value. You will not be asked to do this formula. It's done for you every day by the mutual fund company. But let's say this mutual fund has 1 million shares and securities, stocks, bonds, whatever, worth $10,050,000. They also have to pay off the rent money or whatever. They have to make some payments of $50,000. So if you take the $10,050,000 minus $50,000, you get $10 million. Divide that by the 1 million shares that are outstanding at that day, and you get a $10 net asset value. And that's what you would see if it were an open-end fund and you looked on the internet or wherever. Or if it were a closed-end fund, you might see $9.97, whatever. Now, the offering price for those funds that have a sales commission would be whatever the net asset value is plus the commission of 3 or 5% or whatever it is. So the offering price for those mutual funds that have a commission would be $10.50. And we'll discuss the commissions and the fees in detail in our next presentation. Slide number 13. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of open-end versus closed-end funds? Well, open-end funds are very popular. You're always able to buy and sell. There's no market forces. But this is not your problem as the investor. This is the problem of the fund. What happens if the fund is wildly successful? Nothing breeds success like success in the industry. And so people are going to shower you with love and attention and a lot more money. And now all of a sudden, you've got all this money to invest. It can be a problem. The same thing happens if the fund doesn't do well. People start pulling money out and now you have to sell. Or if the stock market goes down and people just sell because they're frightened. You have to sell some things that you don't normally want to sell. And for this reason, once funds become sufficiently large, and that's, of course, in the eye of the beholder, many mutual fund companies will close the fund. They will say, okay, no more new investors. If you're in the fund, you can stay in the fund, but no more new investors. So the fund will be closed. You'll see, closed to new investors. Other companies say, no problem. All we do is we add more mutual fund managers. So the larger they get, the more resources they put into the mutual fund. And some of them, it works out pretty well because you have mutual funds within mutual funds. You have different managers with different strategies and different investment bents and types, investment ideas. And so you wind up getting a great stew of diversification, which is, my humble opinion, a very good thing. Closed-end mutual funds, you have to pay the broker's commission like a stock, but commissions have gone down quite a bit. They're not free. We'll learn about that in Chapter 3. You have to buy them via the marketplace. And they may be a premium. They may be a discount to the net asset value. Now, the cool thing about closed-end funds, again, this is not something that is important to us because we're just buying the fund. But the closed-end fund does not have to worry about big redemptions or big purchases because there's only so many shares. So they know they have this much money to invest in, and they don't have to worry about those outside forces. Yeah. Which would you prefer? Well, folks, most people are just not even going to know that closed-end funds exist. You, because you're going to be the official investment guru for your friends, family, and colleagues, you need to understand the difference between these two. Okay? All right. Now we're going to throw you a curveball. Because there's a new type of mutual fund that's been around about 30 years now. It's called the exchange-traded funds. And there's tremendous amount of confusion about these. People just assume that there's two types of funds. The mutual fund, which is an open-end mutual fund. They don't know that. They just call it a mutual fund. and ETFs. They think they're different from open-end mutual funds. Well, they're not. They are open-end mutual funds. But they trade on the stock exchange like a closed-end mutual fund. So they're a hybrid. There is no limit to the number of shares, just like in an open-end mutual fund. But now you don't purchase or sell the shares through the mutual fund company. You go to your brokerage account. And that incurs brokerage fees. But that, see, some of these companies are not stupid, especially Fidelity. They're a really good marketing company. Of course, Vanguard has followed suit. They've opened up their own brokerage companies, sister companies. They have the same name, but they're not the same company. And if you buy their ETFs through their brokerage account that you own, then you don't pay any commissions. Very, very smart marketing. ETFs now, exchange-traded funds, are becoming immensely popular. And many people are saying that the old open-end mutual fund is going to disappear. No, not anytime soon. But they are gathering assets at a torrid pace, as we shall see. So you got it, folks? You got the three-way stool now. You have to understand the difference between open-end mutual funds and closed-end mutual funds, and then this new hybrid exchange-traded fund, which is really an open-end mutual fund in that there's no limit on how many shares, but it's a closed-end mutual fund because it is bought and sold on the stock exchanges. Look at the growth of the industry. Starting in 2006, we had about $423 billion. 2011, they crossed a trillion. 2015, they crossed two. 2017, three. 2019, four, five, six, seven. And as of the end of 2022, $6.5 trillion. Probably over seven by now because of how well 2023 did. But notice that 2008 was a very difficult year, even as the number of funds continues to be created at a large growth rate, continuing apace is what I wrote here. So ETFs are the new kid on the block, and you will hear pundits, talking heads, self-appointed experts saying that they're going to destroy the old open-end mutual fund. They won't even say open-end mutual fund, they'll just say mutual fund, as if they were different. They're both open-end mutual funds, but they're different in that from an open-end mutual fund in that they're sold on the exchange. And we'll talk about more about these things later on because there's more confusion to be had. How are mutual funds regulated? Well, you know, in this day and age of divided government and angry people shouting at one another, it's hard to believe that the folks in the sandbox in Washington can play nice together, but they, in the past they have. The Investment Company Act of 1940 is the foundation of the modern mutual fund industry. It defined what is called a regulated investment company, a pass-through investment vehicle. You see, when you make money, the IRS says, ooh, excuse me. We're your Uncle Sam, your partner, and of course, California, Uncle Cal is interested. But the mutual fund company said, no, you don't understand. We're making money for our investors. We're going to pass through the rewards to the investor. Go tax them. Okay, all right, that makes sense. Okay, that's exactly how it works now. To qualify, an investment company must hold all their assets as investments in stocks, bonds, and other traditional securities, and they have very limited ability to use derivatives and other risky strategies. Well, recently, I don't know how they get away with it. I really haven't researched it. I should. There are mutual funds that are using very risky strategies that could make you very wealthy overnight and make you very sad overnight. And I don't know how they get away with it, but they do. So I really should learn more about this. The truth is, I don't want to know. I want to do my best to avoid these things, and I hope you'll do the same. But, you know, you might like Las Vegas, you might like gambling. very important, is they must use no more than 5% of their assets when acquiring a particular security. So let me see, what does that mean? If you can't use more than 5% and there's 100% of assets, that means you must have at least 20 different securities, 20 different stocks, 20 different bonds. You see, they're encouraging you to diversify. Now, as we said, many have 100 or 200, but you must have at least 20. And once you're above 5%, you can still hang on to your investment, but you can't buy more. So you'll see some mutual funds that have made a big bet on a certain company, or just, you know, it's just been decades they've held it, and they now have 8, 9, 10, 12% of their assets in just one company, but the manager loves that company so much that they don't want to sell. They must also create an organization with what are called checks and balances, and you might have heard that, the disappearance thereof in our government of checks and balances. And so here is my little graphic. Often you see these upside down where the shareholders at the top. I don't think that makes sense. I think I'd like to put the shareholders at the bottom because we're the base of the mutual fund. And we elect a board of directors. Most people don't know what they're doing. They just get something in the mail or email saying, are these people okay? And they, okay, yeah, sure. But the board of directors are responsible for overseeing the management of the fund on behalf of the shareholders. They are not responsible for the choices of investments. No. Their job is to make sure that the fund is being run correctly, to choose the investment manager, to watch over them, and act on behalf of the investors. So they're your watchdogs. Now, in the past, some of these boards of directors have been accused of just being rubber stamps. Oh, whatever, you know, sure, we're okay with that. So now 75% of the board must be independent of the mutual fund organization. And of course, a lot of, you know, muckety mucks wind up with these jobs because they treat them very well, pay them very well. And some do a good job and some don't do a very good job because nothing's perfect. The board of directors then sponsors the mutual fund, which, notice, is a corporation made up of different parts. It is not one monolithic item. The most important part is up here in the upper left-hand corner, the investment advisor, the management company. These are the people in the top hats. They're the people who make the decisions. They're the ones who go knocking on the doors of Ford and GM and Honda and Toyota and Tesla and say, yeah, we want to own GM and Tesla. We don't want to own BMW and Honda. Right. That's their job. But do they actually hold on to the shares? No. That's the job of the custodian on the right-hand side. The custodian is a separate company that holds the investment choices. So the investment manager can't just pick up and run with them. The custodian, which is usually a bank, or a trust company, they're called trust companies, that's their job. In fact, there's a very big one, that State Street Trust, Bank and Trust, that now is a mutual fund company. And they started, well, I don't know if they started doing this, but for many years, I think they still do. If you wanted to start a mutual fund company, you could hire them as your custodian. So you didn't have to recreate the wheel and create a custodian from scratch. The two entities at the bottom here, the distributor and the transfer agent, they're responsible for the distribution of the shares through the brokerage firms or directly to the public. So the distributor is the marketer. You can think of the marketing part end of the mutual fund company. And the transfer agent is the entity that actually does the transactions. They process the purchase and the redemption orders. Now, in the middle of our graphic are the independent public accountants. You might have heard of Ernst & Young or Deloitte and Touche. They're now called Deloitte. Price Waterhouse. These are the big accounting firms. And their job is to go in there and audit the books. Okay, you say you have 100,000 shares of whatever, IBM or Microsoft tech companies. They then go over to the custodian and say, okay, where are they? Okay, here they are. Yeah, okay. So their job is to make sure that everything is run on the up and up. Right. There's $30 trillion in these things, folks. We don't want them sneaking off with our money. So slide now 18 and 19 are just what we discussed on the graphic. The mutual fund is a corporation run by the board of directors on behalf of the shareholders, the investors. They oversee the fund's operation. The investment advisor is the management company that makes the decisions. They have portfolio managers, sometimes called portfolio counselors, mutual fund managers. Sometimes it's a team, sometimes it's a committee, sometimes it's a star manager. The research analysts usually focus on a specific industry, and they're the ones who are banging on the doors. The custodian actually holds the securities on behalf of the shareholders. On slide 19, the distributors are the marketing organization that is bringing the shares to the public through brokerage firms or directly to the public. And the transfer agent keeps track of those purchase and redemption requests for the shareholders. The independent public accounting firm then certifies the fund's financial operations and reports. Why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect shareholders' investments from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company? Well, until 2003, you never heard. Wait a minute, Pliano. Did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been regulated and escaped any hint of impropriety. I like that word, impropriety. Yeah, it means hanky-panky, travesuras. In 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. It was only a handful of people, handful of funds, Strong Funds, Janus, Bank of America, I call it Bank of Armenia, Putnam, poor George Putnam rolling over in his grave, and Alliance Funds. There were two people in the entire organization. Alliance is a good company. We're going to see one of their funds in the next presentation. Two people, and Alliance almost disappeared. They merged with another company, and now they're called AB. Silly name. Putnam almost disappeared. Strong did disappear. Strong Funds was started by a guy named Richard Strong, a pillar of his community. And at the time, I think he was worth like $600 million. And he destroyed his life. He destroyed the company. He was very contrite. He said, I ruined it. I let down all the people who looked up to me. He was very upset. Now, what was he doing? What were these people doing? It wasn't quite illegal, but it was obviously unethical. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, don't worry about it because it's not important, because it's not happening anymore. But mutual funds are required at the end of every business day in New York, which is 4 o'clock New York time, 1 o'clock our time in California, to, as we said, find all the prices of the securities, sum them all up, and then take out any liabilities and divide by the number of shares and come up with the net asset value. Well, at 4 o'clock New York time, the market closes in the United States. But a couple hours later, it's going to open up in Japan and the Far East. So what would these people do if the market in the United States, say, went down 2%? They would sell their Japanese fund, which is still at yesterday's price, because the market in Japan hasn't opened yet, assuming that Japan's stock market was going to fall, which is typical. You know, they go in waves. They go around the world in waves and then change on a dime. But if the United States market goes down quite a bit, chances are Asia is going to go down the next day, but not necessarily. Then they turn around and buy it back the next day. You see what they just did? They're stealing pennies from their fellow investors. Now, many companies just never engaged in this. Some companies, like Oppenheimer, which is now Invesco, and Franklin. Sure, you could do that, but we're going to charge you 2% to do that. Sure, you want to do that? Fine, go right ahead. But if you sell the fund and then buy it back within 30 days or 60 days, we're going to hit you with a 2% penalty. Other companies just said, fine, you want to sell it? You can't buy it back for 30 days. That's fine. It's fine with us. If you want to sell your shares, but you can't turn around and buy them back. In other words, they were using mutual funds as trading vehicles and arbitraging that tiny little difference between one day to the next. Yeah, and Dick Strong made about $600,000, I think it is. Look it up. And this is a guy who was worth $600 million. I mean, he said it's like a Greek tragedy, the hubris they call it. He started to believe all the things that people said about him, all the wonderful things they said about him. Because I'm just a guy, you know. So it wasn't a big deal, but it still was not right. And Dick Strong is no longer able to work in the industry. He was barred from the industry for life. The two people at Alliance were barred for life. Instead of losing $99,999.99 on a $100,000 account, those people who put their 401ks, who worked for Enron or WorldCom, into the one stock because their boss told them that it was going to go up forever, you lost a penny. You probably didn't even lose a penny, but you still lost. You know, you're still on a $100,000 account, maybe you lost one or two pennies. So it's not good. And it's no longer an issue. Cool? Okay. So now, go back over this information. Make sure you understand the growth of the industry, the difference between open-end, closed-end ETFs. Because in our next presentation, we have to deal with fees and share classes. And the industry is going to do their best to confuse you and make sure you have no idea how you're being charged, but you're going to know better. You are going to be the official investment guru for your friends, family, and coworkers, and you're going to be able to say, oh, no, 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 this is not right. Cool? Okay. See you in our next presentation.